Talk Shoe. Recorded live.
Good morning, everybody, or good afternoon. This is Rick Reynolds. It is the some date here, 22nd of March, 2010, and we're glad you're on the call today. And somehow it is saying right now, flashing that we're waiting for the host. We're not waiting for the host, so good. Now, for the questions we have today, let's see here. We'll line things up a bit more. Excuse me, guys, while I straighten up my... Okay, there we go. Now I see everything. Okay, so questions for today. To begin, we have one here. Once again, the media is having a field day with infidelity. Sandra Bullock and her husband, now added to Tiger Woods. I've seen statistics that are broadcasting about what the public thinks about infidelity, whereas I cannot deny that what people survey think, it is not helpful for my wife and for my recovery, for our own recovery. Also, the fact that most of the people surveyed probably have not gone through recovery from infidelity. They're speaking more merely hypothetically. We're being very aggressive in our recovery and seeing progress, but I just wish the media would not be blasting this stuff all over the place. It's not helpful, especially for my wife, who was betrayed. And I especially hate the fact that the media's intent is to sell stories, not to be helpful to those going through this. I guess that would be too Pollyanna-ish in my thinking. Therefore, they are not citing success stories or citing people who are informed like yourself. Here are a few questions. How do we navigate this, get perspective, knowing that it is part of our world and will not go away? Two, is there another resource other than ARC where we can access success stories from infidelity? I know my wife draws encouragement from the stories of others who have gone through this and have survived and even thrived. Thank you so much. Yeah, I agree. The media makes this thing just, it's a field day out there. I'm going to try to write something this week about that, actually, just to kind of address the issue. It's a huge problem. You know, how do you navigate it? At one level, this may sound funny, but I kind of just pray for those people. I mean, I think just knowing that you know something they don't know, you know, I hope that you and your wife in the long run almost take the perspective, if you can, that, you know, we want to be one of those voices, maybe a light in the dark that says, you know, we can actually do something about this, that the world doesn't have to stay in this kind of crazy state where people listen to all of this stuff all the time. I mean, it's really sad. I agree with you on that. And I think one of the things I do, is I try not to listen to the media too much. I try to listen to things that I know that are going to be positive for recovery, so I would certainly listen to good sources where there's some encouragement. I know that one of our mentor couples is on Dr. Oz, and that'll be, I don't know when it's going to be broadcast, but there's a hope story there. We'll do our best to get as many of the hope stories out there, and just know that people, and I think your point, people who haven't gone through it just don't know. And the fact is, if those people, even Sandra and her husband, got the help they needed, they could get better. I mean, research has shown that time and time again. It's just right now, people like to have a scapegoat and couples that fall, and we think it's tragic, and they make those people a scapegoat, and then they, you know, it's how awful and all of that crud. So I'm the best thing I know is don't pay it too much mind. You know something, you know the truth. I mean, once upon a time, everybody thought the world was flat, too. And over time, people began to realize that it wasn't, you know, there was proof that it was different. And you guys have that proof. Other than another resource on success stories from infidelity, there's a little book that you might want to read. It's called Can My Marriage Be Saved? And it is by May Chambers, C-H-A-M-B-E-R-S, and Erica Chambers. And it also just has stories that share couples who make it. I think that, you know, reading things, other books on infidelity, Torn Asunder certainly has books that talk about being saved. Jerry and Mona Schreiber and their work talks a lot, you know, just about books, about people who've been able to get beyond it. Unfaithful is their book. Gary and Mona Schreiber, Unfaithful, Hope and Healing After Infidelity. They've got lots of examples of people who've been saved. So that would be the place I would start. You're probably just going to find it in books. I'm not aware of other websites, per se, like ARC that is providing videos or stories. I hope your wife will get on and watch as many of the mentor videos as possible. So I think those might be helpful for her, and I will make sure that we got enough posted that you won't run out. How's that? I'll continue to try to do that. Here's a question on sexual addiction. Does a sex addict have to be on the hunt for sex always? I am not sure if my husband is a sex addict. He used pornography, online searches for women, even emailed some, and had what he calls an emotional affair. He has not disclosed too much yet, but promises that there was never any sex. He has other addictions that he is in recovery for at this time. What do you call these actions then? Are they addicted to women, relationships, sex, etc.? I want my husband to heal, but is afraid that he's not facing another addiction that could greatly affect our lives and the restoring of our marriage. So, obviously, I will tell you, not everybody that looks at porn is a sex addict. Not everybody that, you know, has an affair is a sex addict. But addictions actually have some very specific qualities. And I think it has a little bit to do with, well, I know it has a lot to do with there's a dependency to that particular piece. There's an ongoing tolerance where they need more and more and more of it. There are attempts to cut back and to stop it, but they continue to fail. So, I mean, there are characteristics that if those aren't there, then it is possible that somebody's operating out of something other than an addiction. I mean, that people abuse alcohol, they're not necessarily addicts. People may even get DWIs because they really abuse alcohol and do horrible things, but that doesn't necessarily make them an alcoholic. Your question with your husband, if this is an ongoing issue where it's continued to escalate, that would certainly raise questions for me. Certainly, the fact that somebody has never had sex is not an indication whether somebody is a sexual addict. I have a lot of people that are emotional addicts, but they're far more interested in the grooming behaviors. What they're addicted to is getting the attention. They're not addicted to having sex at all. I've got a lot of guys that have looked at porn, never been with another person. But what happens is it takes up more and more and more and more of their life, so it really begins to interfere with their ability to function in life. And in that case, I don't care if they're having sex or not. It's totally, you know, it's kind of capturing them, and that behavior has become far more important than anything else. And one way I look at addictions is that your need for love and your need to be loved and your need for just going close to the source of love. And Grace and Addiction talks about this, Myers, Mays, I think, I can't think of his name. Jeremiah, I think. I just went blank. But in that book, he says it's when my need for love, my need to grow close to the source of love, and my need to be loved or to give love, when those get attached to a substance, a person, or a behavior, that is a little bit of what addiction is about. That ultimately we're looking to that other, something other than the right thing or the God-intended thing to meet those basic core needs. And that's exactly what the alcoholic or the sex addict does. I mean, they're not okay if they don't have that particular behavior going on. And they try to hide the behavior. They try to manage the behavior. The compulsion, there's a strong compulsion to the behavior. And it is beginning again to impact their lives. Hopefully for your husband, it's not sexual addiction. Obviously, the thing that I would say to anyone, whether though they are a sex addict or not, and it is if for the two of you, monogamy is defined in such a way that that's kind of a breach of your marital contract, what he's been doing, emotional affairs or whatever. I mean, certainly there's something wrong in that sense then, if that's kind of a violation of who you are as a couple, and he needs to figure out what that's about. And the second thing, when someone says they won't ever do it again, you know, if you've ever heard me speak, that is something that scares me to death, because just the fact that they've done it the first time means they're more than capable of doing it a second time. And the only way I know whether someone can do something is if they've done it before. So whether they're an addict or they're not an addict, just like in, I think, your recovery maybe as a hurt spouse, I need to identify what are those bottom line behaviors that I know I'm capable of that I know are destructive and that are contrary to love, and what am I going to do to make sure I don't place myself in circumstances where that sort of thing can happen again. Because good intentions are never enough to stop behaviors. You never intended, for instance, if you're physically abusive to your husband, whatever, you probably never would have never intended on the day you got married to be physically abusive. Or if you're verbally abusive in your anger, you probably never would have thought maybe you said some of the things you thought. I mean, your intentions have always been different, but now you find yourself acting in a new way. The problem gets to be then, if I know I can do that, I just have to accept that I can be that way and then live in a way that keeps me out of that. And that's where acceptance, I think, is so critically important. So, you know, I don't know whether he needs to face another addiction, but I do know he needs to face what he's capable of, and he needs to take responsibility for keeping the marriage safe, and hopefully he'll even assure you of kind of what he's doing, and before you'll know, at least he gets the fact that it's an issue and he's going to do something to stay safe. Overcoming fears. Why is it so difficult to overcome fears, my fears? Why is hiding so mine is hiding. Sorry about that. So much easier than addressing. Maybe I know why. It will be easier to accept myself as is and not feel like I need to hide myself from everyone. Maybe if I know why, why is hiding so much easier than addressing myself? Maybe if I know why, it'll be easier to accept myself as is. You know, I think that it really depends on the why is what you're living for. That's always what you're living for. It's kind of which consciousness, which program, which life model are you operating from? If your life model is self-serving, if it's self-centered, then being honest and being intimate will always be incredibly difficult. If you're living for the approval of other people, then being honest will always be incredibly difficult. If you're living out of a model, I would say, of love, where you're mostly concerned about other people and not nearly as concerned about self, where integrity kind of holds another issue, it's almost like living out of the principles of, you know, just rigorous honesty and, you know, staying focused on your own peace and not taking yourself too doggone seriously. If you're in that mode, then being intimate and being honest is very important. You know, I think you always have to get back to what is important to me in life and what am I really living for? What's the goal? And I guarantee you, if you're egocentric and self-centered, most likely being honest won't work, just because you're typically going to be, well, and if it's about not being a disappointment. Now, if you are a sociopath and you just don't care about other people, you'll say anything because you don't care how you're impacting them. But if you do care and you're looking to them rather than, and honestly, thinking about what other people are thinking about you, even if you're thinking about other people, even though because you're thinking about what they're thinking about you, is still 100% totally self-centered. And that's why I say, if you're looking for other people, you're going to have trouble being honest. You know, I think that the part of the deal is, I need to accept that I'm the way I need to be. The other piece there is me telling myself there's a certain way that I needed to be that somehow I missed the mark. And things accept, self-acceptance and humility are huge. Of course, the problem is, again, we want people to accept us, but maybe even at a higher level as I go through, just being more concerned about other people than myself, it goes a long way to helping, I think, be open and honest. Because at least then I'm giving them what they need. I'm revealing to them maybe honestly who I am, and hopefully they can deal with that. I mean, I don't want to be brutal when I'm being honest either, by the way. I mean, I think that I've got to be always careful as I speak to be considerate of other people. At the same time, that whole self-acceptance thing and beginning to get beyond your shame is going to be huge if you want to overcome that fear. Maybe I don't know that I fully answered that. Why is it so difficult to overcome my fears? Why? I think I mentioned the second part. Why is hiding so much easier than addressing? Boy, I guess it's still, you know, the other aspect of fears that I would say overcoming fears is that we think we know how other people will respond if they know. And it's back to our trying to manage and control, and all of our fears are about being out of control and not managing. And letting go, I think, and letting God, that whole thing is just huge in this process. So I don't know if that helps a little bit. I think you just have to quit anticipating what's going to happen in the future, and you do the next right thing and trust that God will give you the grace to walk through that as long as you're walking where you need to walk. Could you explain, here's the next one. Rick, could you please explain the different circumstances that can affect the recovery process? What kind of milestones and markers affect it, and how long the recovery process generally takes? This is asked with the full understanding that it's not the same for each couple, but at least a rough idea. Yeah, and it's really not the same for each couple. Somebody who's really been traumatized or has a very traumatic childhood is going to take longer than somebody who was very, you know, and very secure growing up and has a really strong sense of self. Somebody who's extremely angry and has had a ton of anger all their life may have more difficulty than, you know, somebody who, you know, is just depressed. I mean, I don't know, but the different circumstances that can affect the recovery process, obviously the complication comes because there are two different people in a couple's recovery process. And the race, race may not be the right word, but that makes it incredibly complicated. And also the things that can affect the recovery process not only are the two individuals and their personalities, but also the level of support that they're getting, positive support for recovery versus the people in their lives that are putting pressure on them not to recover. It's interesting, I was talking to a couple last week where part of the problem is their kids don't want them to get back together, and so it's actually taking much longer in some ways, largely because of outside forces and how to work all of that out. So even the magnitude of what's occurred and the impact on the family is affecting that timeline. That being said, milestones and markers, generally when I think about it, how quickly you get the information out is absolutely huge. And getting the story out is milestone number one. As soon as that story is told, where we basically know what the story is, then we're able to go to the next phase, which is really about maybe the next step of creating kind of a place where we can begin a safe environment to begin to heal. It's almost like, do we have maybe a forum to work in that keeps us kind of on path or that we can function within? And so the creating of the boundaries and the safety and kind of agreed upon that we're going to do it, that's another milestone. We're going to at least give it a try for a certain period of time and see if something is there. So to an extent, there's an initial commitment, I think, to try to at least explore and decide that we're going to move forward, maybe not knowing what that looks like. Because if you never really make the commitment to do anything one way or the other, you're not moving forward. Hopefully that the story is out within the first 6 weeks. I would hope within the next couple of weeks that there's pretty much by the end of that time period too, I would really like to see couples kind of know that they're going to at least try to move forward. And so now they've told the story, I think that the reaction stage, that's through the revelation stage, the reaction stage of grieving, the grieving stage is huge. And that there's a lot that needs to happen in that next stage that I think takes about 3 months. And much of it's about making sure we get more to the whys, not only the what happened, but maybe we get a joint history of maybe why it happened a little bit, kind of understanding of that. It's huge in terms of hope in the relationship. Again, empathy begins to get developed, and that needs to happen again within that first 90 days. And then an understanding, again, of kind of relapse prevention, again, that we're on the same page of what it's going to take to make this thing safe. A willingness, I think both parties need to see a willingness of the other person to address or to do what's necessary to kind of help us move forward. It's not helpful. And so I think that joint working together, the mutuality is important. Sometimes what I'll see in that first 90 days that kind of block things is the hurt spouse may say, or the unfaithful, but the hurt spouse may say, well, I didn't cause this, and so really you've got to do all the work. And so there's an unwillingness then on their part to kind of participate in the process. And the problem is if you do that it's still, whether they caused it or not, if the relationship is going to move forward, it's still got to be a bit of a joint process. And I know that's not fair, but I use the analogy, if I'm driving a car and have a wreck and injure Stephanie, she has nothing to do with it. She's in the car with me. I caused this to wreck. She still has to do the physical therapy, however, if she broke both legs, she's going to learn how to walk again. Now, she could also choose not to do the physical therapy so that I have to carry her everywhere from that day forward to punish me for the fact that I was careless or reckless or whatever, or made a mistake and wrecked the car. But that's not going to be leading toward a healthy relationship. Hopefully, I'm willing to do what I need to do to help her heal, and hopefully she's willing to do what she can do to heal. So there's a question. What if you know it's very unlikely that empathy will never happen? So in those cases, I'm sorry, what? Were you saying something? Okay. What if you know that it's very unlikely that empathy will never happen? Well, if empathy is never going to happen, then the problem is in terms of the timeline, that relationship only, I think, has the capacity to go to a certain point. And if you're willing to be in a relationship that, you know, is somewhat walks with a limp and is impaired, but there, because there sometimes are other reasons that people stay in a relationship where it's not, I think, what from maybe your standard, the world standard, would consider like a really great relationship. Some people have reasons they want to stay in a relationship that's, you know, where someone really is pretty incapacitated emotionally. And so that would certainly be a really difficult situation, but it's going to be more one-sided in the recovery at that point, because that means the hurt spouse is going to have to be carrying the responsibility pretty much for the relationship going forward, because they're not going to be getting anything back from the other person. And to me, getting something back from the other person is, I mean, I would want, you know, I think in my heart's desire to be able to get the other back. And I'd like to end up with an understanding where it becomes like working together on this, where we're reconnected and we have a relationship. Because when someone doesn't have empathy and they're just saying, get over it, I won't do it again. You may continue in a relationship like that for certain reasons, but the level of connection will always be incredibly limited, just because the other person doesn't have the capacity in many ways to connect. So you can't say you have to dump it, because I think there are reasons people stay in relationships like that, but it wouldn't be one that probably has a lot of life. And then, so 9 months, I think at about I usually see couples at the end of that 90 days, that first 3 months, as they begin to work together and they're kind of doing their own individual work or their couples work, they actually get better pretty quickly. I do think each party, it's helpful if they see the other person kind of doing what's necessary to do better. That's especially helpful, I think, for the hurt spouse, if they can see the one who's been unfaithful kind of working on their issues. Now, sometimes if you've got a hurt spouse who's just interested, or unfaithful spouse who just wants them to kind of get over it and go on, they actually will try to be in kind of almost an impediment to their mate getting help, or I wonder why we're still talking about it. Why do we keep going through this stuff? And so there's a little bit of pushback at that point sometimes after the initial 90 days, where someone else is trying to say, well, let's just move on and not look at it. Why do you feel like you still need to be, you know, I don't want you to be hurting anymore. And it almost like they're being run through the mud. Hopefully, you know, the unfaithful spouse, to me it helps if the unfaithful spouse just says, look, you do what you need to heal. You know, usually from 6 months to 12 months, I find if they're both kind of doing their thing, that they do much better until about 1 year. And at 1 year, the wheels come off the bus, typically only because reminders begin to happen again and because of the anniversary dates. And at that point, typically, couples typically do a little worse at the end of the year, at the 12-month point. And then after that, probably 30 days in there, then they start getting better, those reminders begin to subside. And in the timeline of recovery for a couple, the reminders actually are a huge kind of driver of this thing. So the intensity of the reminders over time have a lot to do with the amount of emotional flooding that continues to occur for the hurt spouse, or maybe even the unfaithful spouse, and the level of upset that might actually still be in that relationship and the need to continue to talk. But typically after a year, unless you're dealing with severe trauma or that 13-month point, couples pretty much have a nice upward spin. If they're still doing what's necessary and they've kind of learned a lesson from the whole thing, if they kind of redeemed what happened and transformed the loss. And now typically have a much deeper, intimate connection. Usually the intimacy is better even after the first 6 to 8 weeks, simply because for the first time, maybe they're really talking about things. And that's what you want to see at the very beginning of this thing. And hopefully by 2 to 3 years, what occurs for a couple is that, you know, this is something that was in their past, but it's not the thing that they live around. It's just something they kind of integrated, but they're now moving forward and they're enjoying life again. And I mean, they're careful to guard their marriage. They don't go back to assuming that nothing could happen, but they also don't live in fear of something happening, because there's enough time and enough proof and enough recovery that they see that, you know, they can go forward. Occasionally in that recovery process, it's like in some instances, somehow, you know, they may, one or the other person in the relationship may be kind of stuck, afraid to kind of just go forward without always watching this thing or being, quote, hyper-vigilant, trying to keep something from happening. Certainly, I don't think it's good for a couple to be hyper-vigilant, simply because I think it's there may be a place in the beginning to make sure everything's okay, but as we move on, I just want couples to come to peace and just know that the other person is looking out for their best interest, and together they live life well and strongly. So I hope that made a little bit of sense there. And so you're gonna again, from just a summation there, you're gonna see the first 6 weeks revelation, a lot of upset, the grieving happens, and that grieving process, by the way, and that this can go on for a very long time. Different people grieve differently, and for anybody that, you know, is willing to walk through it, I mean, I am a strong believer in the need to kind of face it, address it, and move from it. I have never met anybody that I think that has grieved something well that ever blames anybody on the other side. And the only way I know for pain to truly be transformed is ultimately by the willingness to walk through it, to grieve it, to cry about it, to accept it, to look at it, you know, to understand it, you know, in the best you can, to see God in it, and then, you know, to come to that place of acceptance where you say, good, and you let it go, and there's a peace. I mean, but where that pain has yet to be transformed, there will always be a tendency to blame and not be able to look at self. And, you know, there's certainly in this timeline that I just said, I think after 6 months in particular of recovery, I'm always hoping that both parties are focused far more even on their own issues than they are on the couple's issues, that the relationship is stabilized enough that they each have the opportunity to begin to take responsibility and look honestly at themselves and what type of person ultimately do they want to become? Who do they want to be in life? Because this is a chance to do a do-over and move forward with life, and hopefully they do that. Why are anniversaries so painful? Can it hurt spouse, not just wedding anniversaries, but anniversaries of D-Day, holidays? What can we do in to anticipate some of these problems and be proactive in dealing with them? You know, the best thing to do with anniversary dates, I think, is not the anniversary, but like she's saying D-Day anniversary. And that's a great question. I've never addressed this one before. But man, I would say if you could actually put on the calendar, maybe I need to get people to do this, like in the beginning, say, okay, D-Day is March 12th. We need to anticipate that things are going to be going a little bit crazy. Maybe an exercise you could do is at 6 months, if you could write a letter to yourself at 12 months, saying, let me tell you where things are at right now, because I know that things aren't going to be nearly as good for you here in about 6 months. And I want you to read this and remember where we're at today so that you don't think where you're at 12 months from now is ultimately what's going to happen in your life. And that might be a good exercise. So if anybody's at about 6 months out, write yourself a, what I call a sunny day letter or a rainy day letter, where you save it for the rainy day when things are hard again so you can remember what it was like. Because most likely at the 12-month mark, again, it's not nearly as much about the things that have gotten worse as it is that the reminders, because of the anniversary date, are just naturally going to begin to pick up. And the more you get those intrusive thoughts, the more emotional plotting, and it's like over time, the intensity or the frequency of those intrusive thoughts is going to actually stir the emotions to the point where it's going to be a problem. The second thing you can do at the point of anniversaries that I think is really helpful because of those intense reminders is to go back and review kind of the battlefield of the mind, that video on kind of capturing thoughts. It's not, guys, when you think about grieving, it's not that all intrusive thoughts are bad. Getting hit with painful things isn't good or bad in and of itself. The problem when that emotional flood comes as a result of reminder, the problem is how I'm responding to those emotions. Is that helpful? Is it healthy grieving, or is it unhelpful? Is it something that's counterproductive to me and to my marriage and to my life? Because there are ways that I respond to pain, like lashing out, being angry, screaming, yelling, maybe my own self-loathing, self-contempt. All of that's not healthy grieving. And you want to get to the place that when those feelings come, you're in a healthy, you have appropriate ways. You stop and you look at it and you cry about it and you write about the things maybe you lost from it, but you also maybe write about the things that you're grateful for. You begin to try to get balance in the things if you let yourself feel it and you talk to other people who can validate it. And I mean, those are healthy ways to mourn. It's just the other ways where maybe you try not to say anything about it, you try to stuff the feelings, you try to transmit your pain to somebody else or anger. Those are unhealthy ways. So it's not a matter of saying, I don't want the triggers. It'd be nice if I didn't have the triggers. It's really choosing how I want to respond and being very intentional. And in 12 months, if you'll just go back and review some materials of what is a healthy way to grieve, what's an unhealthy way to grieve, and even try to utilize that as a way to take you maybe through the last vestiges of working through the pain around that thing, that can be very helpful. I wish those anniversaries didn't come, but they do. Here's another one. Thanks for your valuable advice. I hope it can be. At what point should the questioning about the details of the infidelity stop? That's a great question, by the way. It's been about 5 months since my husband confessed his one-night stand, and it seems like I am in a cycle of obsessive questioning and then denial that this even happened to us. Do you have any suggestions on how to cope more on recovery? To me, we question for several reasons. And there's one point, I think that getting your mind around it is the primary point of questioning. Once you understand what happened, and I don't know that there's a lot of benefit that begins to happen anymore from that questioning. So, if someone's at the place, I understand that there may be something in your mind that kind of comes up, but there may be better, more productive ways of dealing with that kind of nagging issue, like going back and kind of reviewing what you already know without feeling like you've got to answer the question again. Because it's almost like if you can't stop having to always go back and repeat a behavior, maybe a task you've already completed, if you can't ever complete the task, you can't begin to move forward to the next task. You don't want to get stuck in the questioning stage. And a lot of times people begin to use questioning, I think, as a way of reassurance. Well, if I ask the question, you answer the question once again at 5 months, at 5 years, at 7 years, I know that you're really there with me. But you've never been able, if you can't handle it another way besides questioning, it's hard for you then to begin to move forward. So I would say there comes a point where you've got to say, I understand it. I get it. You know, there's not going to be any new information. Now, there may be an occasional question like, is anything happening now? But that's not the same as about questioning the same event over and over again. And so I think you've got to draw a line in the sand for yourself and you know you're done with it and say, I'm done with it. Now, what am I going to do what are my chosen responses going to be whenever those nagging issues come up again? Now, I want to find a new or a healthier way of dealing with it without being stuck with having to be dependent kind of on this particular task. There's got to be a better approach. And sometimes, you know, it's kind of like maybe journaling and saying, I already know the answer to this question. I've answered this question, you know, at least 372 times. The answer's been the same every time. I think you write down maybe the question in a two-column page. On the other side, you put the truth. And then in another column, you might want to put, why do I want to ask the question again? And then you begin to look at that answer because maybe there's another way to get what you really want at the deepest level. I mean, if what you're looking for is assurance, are there other ways to get, you know, assurance besides maybe asking that question? Are there other ways, maybe the why you want to ask the question is it makes you feel safe if your husband's doing, you know, is willing to answer the question, or maybe there's other ways to feel safe. But if the purpose of the question isn't to get information anymore, then I would suggest questioning probably isn't the best technique because it keeps you stuck as a couple in the discovery phase when you really need to be working at the grieving stage. And the questioning thing isn't going to keep you in the grieving stage. It's going to keep you stuck in the discovery stage. Look at this one. Hang on a second, guys. I'm going to have to pause here for a second while I refresh my page. And it's going to kick me out of here because I've been negligent not refreshing as we go through. So I got to log back in. You know, sometimes even for me, logging back in is such an irritation here. Sorry about that. Now back here. And y'all think it's bad when you log in. You ought to see what I see when I log in. I got so much stuff. Okay. So here's the next question. I see, Rick, your Q&A is always so helpful in giving me new understanding on things. Thank you for that. Please talk about what to do when you're really conflicted about what to do in a situation. I finally understand that my husband is very narcissistic, and I don't think he'll ever change. He'll not deal with any issues, doesn't even feel he has any issues, that all the issues are mine, and I just need to get over. Part of me wants to run for the hills, and part of me still loves him and wants things to work out. I'm really tired of what feels very much like verbal and emotional abuse, but at the same time, there are other issues, financial logistics, etc., I would have to face if I did leave. Now that I understand more about narcissistic behavior traits and know it's not about me, I can step back from it to a degree. I just don't know if this will be enough to change to make it survivable for me or not. Any thoughts? Absolutely. So the one thing I would say that has helped people survive for a gazillion years is really about, and this goes back to the question I was answering earlier about how do you be facing fears. But it's kind of like, what are you going to live for? Because the bottom line, if you've got somebody who can never fully do a relationship, or is going to be limited in the type of relationship they can do because of who they are, what's your focus in life? And what type of person do you want to be? I know that, you know, one program like Al-Anon, I think, does a great job of trying to give people maybe principles to live in and to live for. And it keeps the focus very much because on themselves and not the focus so much on their mate. And if you can focus on just becoming fully the person that you want to be, always looking at your inventory, always looking at how to love other people, looking at how you're impacting other people. But if that pursuit kind of becomes your own, becoming who God wants you to be as a woman fully, and just having a much higher view of the world, being concerned about others, reaching out to others, you can find a tremendous amount of meaning for your life apart from the relationship. You can take what you can from the relationship, and you can learn to be detached from the relationship, and you can even still love him in the relationship. But you've got to understand the relationship isn't going to be able to bear all of your emotional needs, and just because you've got somebody who's incapable of doing that. But if you do find, you know, work your own programs, and, you know, whether it be through Accelerated Recovery, whether it's through Al-Anon, whether it's through your church, where you're just, you know, you've got your own goals. Like, what are you going to pursue then? Somebody I heard say once, you know, if you can't go, before you go hanging your hat on a half hook, you want to make sure the half hook can bear the weight. Well, if your husband's very narcissistic, the problem is that hook may not bear the weight. It aren't very much weight at all. And even if he's faithful here on out, you know, you learning, you know, how to find meaning in your own self-acceptance and your own sense of worth is just going to have to be from someplace other than the marriage. So I think just getting really involved in life and getting really involved in other people to some extent. I mean, as I say, life isn't about you. We're supposed to be about life. Well, now, then how do we begin to get really involved in life? And I think that the one thing you don't do is you don't try to manage your husband. I mean, I think you need to keep boundaries. You don't need to. If someone is going to, if you're married to someone who is continually acting out and potentially putting you at risk because of their stuff, and you're not leaving just because of finances, I think, you know, you need to be careful. I've treated too many people with AIDS because male and female have been acting out and maybe in the lifestyle, swinging lifestyle, not what they may know. Are, you know, and then giving them the disease. I mean, there's some issues of safety, I think, that you got to be real careful about. Or if something's, you know, physically abusive, you need to get out of there. But if you have somebody who's just limited in their capacity ultimately to a relationship, and, you know, certainly there are ways to do this. I may have told this story a long time ago, but a lady came into me one day, and I think she probably was in this situation. Well, her mother was, and this woman was in her early 30s, and when I asked how I could help her, she told me that she wanted to divorce her mom, and that was kind of intriguing to me, and I said, well, why do you want to divorce your mom? And she said, well, you know, the problem is, you know, my dad's an alcoholic, and my mom won't leave him, and I think mom should leave him. And I said, well, why do you think your mom should leave your dad? And she said, well, you know, obviously he's never quit drinking. He's never gotten his behavior under control. You know, I'm sick and tired of everything he does. And I'm really disappointed in her because she's chosen to stay with him. And there's got to be something wrong with her. And I said, well, is she codependent? And I said, and she said, well, if she stayed with him, doesn't that mean she's got to be codependent? And I said, I don't know. So I said, let me ask you a couple of questions. With your mom, when your dad goes on a bender, when he gets drunk, well, I said, no, back up. I said, when what is your mom's life like? Because they were retired. I said, well, mom's in a bridge club. She's in a financial investment club. She teaches a Bible study at her church. She mentors several women. I said, so would you say she leads a fairly productive, busy life at this stage of life? Because her mom was in her early 70s. She said, oh, yeah, mom's busy, all right. And I said, okay, so when your mom gets like, your dad goes on a bender, what happens? Because her dad would go off and just disappear for a week when he started drinking. And I said, does her life change? And she said, no, she still goes to church. She goes to her bridge club. She still goes to her financial investment club. I said, so she keeps doing everything. Nothing changes when your dad's gone. And she said, right, mom just kind of goes on about her life doing the things that are important to her. I said, well, what happens when your dad, shows up again? She said that's kind of what, just kind of pisses me off. She takes him back. She nurses him back to health. I said, well, does she keep doing other activities? Oh, yeah, she still goes to the bridge club. She goes to church. She does her mentoring. She does this, she does that. I said, so your mom, emotionally, is she fairly stable through all of it? When your dad's gone, when your dad's back, when he's in the good stage, is your mom kind of more like a steady Freddy, or is she just kind of following his emotional cycle? And she said, oh, no, she definitely just kind of keeps plowing through life as she plows through life. What he does doesn't seem to impact her that much. And so I said, well, I would highly recommend you divorce your mom because I'd actually like to adopt her. And she said, what? And I said, well, I said, I don't think your mom's codependent. I think your mom may be a saint or an angel. But, a codependent is someone who can't be okay without their mate. And apparently, for whatever reason, your mom's just chosen to stay with your dad. She's got a life she's built. Her life doesn't rotate around what your dad does, more or less. She's got things that give her a tremendous amount of meaning, and she feels, for whatever reason, convicted that she's to help take care of this man, and she's going to be there for him. But on the other hand, I don't see where she's the type of person that, is dependent on him in any way. And, it's interesting because the problem, and I did meet this lady later, and I'll tell you, she was really an amazing woman. And so I think that's a very powerful way to begin to deal with it. I hope you don't mind me reading this, but as I'm talking in the chat, somebody wrote that, post-scale, my stuff is, how I ultimately survived. But when I'm with someone who can't respond, it just seems more difficult now that the relationship feels empty. And you bet. I don't have a magic pill or a magic bullet to give you that would somehow make a relationship feel less empty. To some extent, the relationship is empty. There may be some things that, and it would ultimately be you. And this is some of your own personal growth, but I've kind of learned that I'm responsible for whether or not I enjoy my relationship with Stephanie. It's not Stephanie's responsibility to help me enjoy the relationship, nor is it even my responsibility fully to help her enjoy the relationship. But I guarantee you, if I'm enjoying the relationship with her, she certainly enjoys the relationship more. And I think even if your husband is the way he is, I think if you interact in the relationship as best you know how, in the ways that you can live well within that and enjoy him, to the, begin to focus on what do I enjoy in this, and then how do I capitalize on the parts that I really do like. And sometimes we play this game of, do you love me? Do you care for me? And then we kind of had this list of things that if they really cared, they would do. And then we sit there and we wait for them to do those things. And when they don't, we're miserable and we suffer. And to me, if when I'm trying to enjoy the relationship with her, I'm actually not waiting for Stephanie to do anything. I'm actually, you know, making that stuff happen as quick as I can. And, you know, I'm actually taking responsibility and driving it, because I'm not, and not that Stephanie doesn't drive it, I want to be careful here. But I do know that when I'm taking responsibility for making it happen, I'm pretty happy. And all I can say is, I do agree that it would probably be far more difficult, because what an affair does in your type of situation is it takes out a lot of the characteristics that you really probably admired about him and the reasons you saw yourself as being there. I mean, if you saw him as someone with integrity and character, he can even be really narcissistic if you still saw lots of great qualities in him, and you would still be kind of proud and you'd find some reasons for being there. If he's destroyed those through his affair, then hopefully some of those would come back over time. But at the same time, you're still going to have to focus not only on your own recovery, but you're going to have to focus, begin to really ask yourself the question, what can I do with him tonight that would be fun for me? How do I enjoy it? And taking it from that approach, at least if you feel like you need to be there, you can find kind of the maximum life. Just remember, though, you want to stay focused as much as possible on your inventory, not on his. And again, Al-Anon or other groups that, well, you've got other people you can enjoy and share with and be intimate with and be real with. That is going to be very important. So, with all of that being said, it looks like we're at the end of our time for today. Thank you a bunch, everybody, for posting all the questions. Great questions. You guys are a blast. I look forward to next Monday, and we'll just see what happens then. Everybody have a good week, and I'll just talk to you next Monday then. Bye-bye.